Greetings. My name is Bill Kleidke, and I'd like to welcome you to today's edition of Living in Baltimore. Our guest today is Elizabeth Nix, who's Associate Professor of History in the University of Baltimore. And Dr. Nix is here today to talk to us about the history of residential housing segregation in Baltimore and how it impacts what's going on today. So, Dr. Nix, may I welcome you to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for coming. First of all, for those of our listeners who are unfamiliar, and none should be unfamiliar with the University of Baltimore, but could you please tell us a little bit about your background and experience?
Oh, well, thank you. The University of Baltimore is right in the heart of Baltimore City, right across from Penn Station, and we have a law school and a business school, and now have a four-year undergraduate program, and I teach in the history department. We also have a philosophy and legal and ethical studies, a master's program in our division. Mm-hmm. So I've taught there for almost 13 years, and I've lived in Baltimore for 23 years. I live pretty near downtown in Union Square in southwest Baltimore. And my husband and I raised two children here, and both of our sons graduated from City College High School.
Wow. So you're about as Baltimore as you can get.
I did not grow up here, but I have adopted this city and love it as my home.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. And I know that your work has been largely in and around Baltimore.
Right. We've been so lucky to have so many people who are really interested in the history of Baltimore on the faculty of the University of Baltimore. And also I'm on the board of the Baltimore City Historical Society. I'm a commissioner at CHAP, the Commission on Historic and Architectural Preservation. So I've gotten to know a lot of people who have spent their whole lives really devoted to this city, knowing all the assets that it has with its authentic architecture, but knowing also a lot of the issues that housing especially has posed for the city.
Yeah, you know, and continues to pose.
Absolutely.
The I know that your research in the past has included the production of a great book, which I would recommend to anybody who is interested in finding out about today, because I guess that's the credo of history, that we can't know anything about today unless we know how we got here.
Well, I certainly believe that. And that's Baltimore 68 was a project that we did at the University of Baltimore. And I edited the anthology with two colleagues, Jessica Elfenbein and Tom Hollowack. And one of the chapters I wrote in there was with my co-author, Deb Weiner. And we talked about some of the business districts that have been affected in the unrest that followed the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. Mm-hmm. And we did this project. It was an interdisciplinary project on the 40th anniversary of the unrest. And my students at the University of Baltimore interviewed people in the community. And so there are about 70 interviews and the transcriptions of those on the Langsdale Library website at UB. And a wonderful thing about that project was that our students are so, the population of students at UB is so diverse. We had people who had a lot of connections within the community. And so we got a lot of different perspectives of that experience of 1968. So we have this archive of those interviews and documents. And so we created this anthology. And of course, after the unrest of 2015, there was renewed interest in 68, because a lot of the same neighborhoods that experienced violence and unrest in 2015 were the same neighborhoods that had been affected in 68.
Really?
Absolutely. That intersection of West North Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue, where the CVS burned last in 2015. Mm-hmm. That was our chapter that Deb Weiner and I wrote about. We looked at what had happened to West North Avenue and what had happened to Pennsylvania Avenue during 1968. So to see that again erupt in 2015 was very sad for me, but also showed me that there are a lot of things in the city that haven't changed completely since 1968.
The ironic thing, excuse me, if I have my history right, is that that used to be a really, really, really important part of Baltimore. That was the heart of the entertainment district, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Billie Holiday, right?
Sure. Pennsylvania Avenue had the Royal Theater. You can still see the statue of Billie Holiday there today. Mm-hmm. A lot of live music and live entertainment all along that stretch. There were also a lot of retail stores, clubs. It was a very vibrant area.
But I guess that was back in the...
Well, our research, a lot of people look back in 1968 and mistakenly mm-hmm. say, oh, everything was wonderful in Baltimore before 68. And it was that week of unrest that really caused the downfall of Baltimore. Our research showed that, in fact, while people may think that that was the beginning of the decline of Baltimore, the decline had actually been in progress for quite a while. And on Pennsylvania Avenue, there were already vacant buildings. There had already been a decline in live entertainment there. So a lot of the live venues had switched to movies. There was already drug dealing and prostitution along Pennsylvania Avenue in 1968. So it wasn't, people kind of conflate the vibrancy of the 40s and 50s and 60s to that late 60s period. And right. It was already in decline.
And I guess that's kind of typical, isn't it, of other cities, that they've kind of had a long process of decline as opposed to something quickly.
Right, absolutely. The population of Baltimore actually peaked right after World War II. And even though we don't have a census for 1946, we think that probably about 1,250,000 people lived in Baltimore.
1,250,000?
That's really too many people for our city. Our city was packed with people. A lot of these old houses were split into multiple housing units, apartments. The house that I live in is a single family house. We know it had 6 apartments in it. So that was happening all over town. And, you know, my house was built in 1850. If by the 1940s, almost 100 years later, it had already been divided up, that's a lot of pressure on the housing stock. Yeah, it really creates, a situation where you have houses that are not being maintained the way that they should be. The population of Baltimore starts to decline. Baltimore loses 100,000 jobs in the last half of the 20th century. So that also makes people leave, of course. Families get smaller in the last half of the 20th century, so you don't have as many kids living in houses. And so it might not be that many families, as many families as we think leaving, but sometimes just fewer people are living in the city. But all of that was in process, really starting at the end of World War II.
Wow. And so by 1968, I guess all of the elements were in place for, all the elements were in place for it to happen, but did you try to figure out why did it focus on that area?
Well, we found out that there was unrest in 15 different business districts across the city in 1968. Baltimore had the second largest property damage compared to Washington, D.C., which was first. We were second with $13 million worth of property damage. Cities all across the nation, over 100 cities, saw looting, arson, unrest in 1968. So we were among those. People had already looked into the causes of urban unrest, and the federal government, well, like in Watts and Detroit and Newark, the federal government had come out with the Kerner Commission report in March of 1968. And the reasons that they found for urban unrest and before the assassination of Dr. King, with number one, police misconduct, number two, unemployment, and number three, inadequate housing. So a lot of those reasons for urban unrest sound very familiar today.
Yeah, they certainly do. They certainly do. And if anything, some of them have gotten worse.
Yes. Absolutely. So to look in 2015, it's no surprise that those same neighborhoods erupted because decades have gone by, and as you say, in some cases, it's gotten worse.
Yeah, I guess. But there are some differences, and I guess that leaves room for optimism as well as concern, because we know through my organization tries to reduce housing discrimination and discrimination in general and improve human rights. But the dilemma in doing that is that we need the laws, and we have the laws. And now it's a matter of trying to get people to obey the laws. But back in 68, the laws were a lot worse, and there wasn't the coverage, and there wasn't the awareness, and there wasn't all of these things that have happened in between to try to tackle, such as your study, to try to tackle why this was going on and what to do about it.
Right. Well, there certainly have been, before 1968, there were decades of housing discrimination that public policy backed it up. And in Baltimore, we were the pioneers of some of those methods to try to keep races apart. And so I've been talking to a lot of groups around Baltimore since 2015, the spring of 2015, trying to figure out, how did Baltimore get this way? How did we become this hyper-segregated city? And I found it helpful to me to think about the four R's. And the first is racial designation of blocks. And so that's the Black Block, White Block law from 1910 and started here in Baltimore, that said that if you were one race, you had to determine the percentage of people of that race that lived on that block in order to move in. And that was constitutional until 1917. And then the Supreme Court said laws like that had to be eliminated. And then we had residential restrictive covenants. And so those were legal documents attached to deeds that allowed developers to say that you couldn't sell your house to, in some cases, Black buyers, Jewish buyers. So that was in effect all around our region. And then we also had redlining, which Baltimore's was subject to federal government rules, designations of certain areas that said that some were safer to lend to and others weren't. And then finally, roads, the federal highway systems that came through and condemned certain areas to take over for roads. And even if those roads weren't built, you still had the effects of disinvestment, because are you going to fix your roof if you are in the pathway of a federal highway that's coming through? So I really think that those four policies, laws, ordinances that came through Baltimore and cities like it in the 20th century led to these patterns that we're still seeing the effects of today.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And future predictions. We're down to our last minute here.
Sure. Well, I have hope for Baltimore. I think people see the value in the housing stock in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. It's a different time than 68. In that period, people were moving to the suburbs. We're in the opposite period now. People are moving back into the cities and seeing the value of the cities. And I think that Baltimore is aware that we want to keep the people that we have here. We don't want gentrification to take over neighborhoods. And I think that we've seen what that's happened, that has happened in other cities. And we're going to really work to try to keep all of our citizens here, build a stronger housing stock, and attract new people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you. How can someone get in touch with you to find out more information about you and your book?
Oh, well, my email address is enix, so Elizabeth Nix, E-N-I-X, at ubalt.edu, ubalt.edu.
Okay, great. And the book's name is?
Baltimore 68, Riots and Rebirth in an American City.
And you can buy it on Amazon or
hopefully
on one of your local bookstores. Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. This has been very interesting, and I hope our listeners have learned something about Baltimore's history and hopefully some lessons that we all need to work on to make things better in the future. So thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest today in Living in Baltimore has been Elizabeth Nix, Associate Professor of History for the University of Baltimore. Thank you, Dr. Nix.
Thank you.
Keep up your good work for all of us. And for Living in Baltimore, I want to thank you for tuning in. Let's try to be a good neighbor out there in all of our neighborhoods, and we'll see you next time.